Have you given any thought to contributing to The Melt? It's easy to do. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and for as little as $3 a month, you can get access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. It helps to keep the magic happening here at The Melt. So I encourage you to karmically entangle yourself with The Melt today by subscribing monthly for less than the price of a container of goatee wax, or a prosthetic pinky, or a half stick of DMT butter, or an inflatable casket, or the shrunken head of an Atlantean supermodel, or a woolly mammoth's merkin, or a crystalline replica of Baba Yaga's hut, or a capsule of Sasquatch dander. Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. Anthropology has a long history of approaching the peoples that it has studied derogatorily, as if they exist in some removed and primitive subculture that resembles more the exception than the rule. It's the same sort of arrogance that many modern fields of study possess, as if contemporary Western culture has all the answers and that those who've come before it are hopelessly misled in thinking that they are intrinsically interconnected with their environment and each other, and that it benefits all the parties involved to act harmoniously within that web of existence. Contemporary Western culture tends to compartmentalize and categorize things as if they're separate, thinking that there is some advantage in specializing in fragments rather than approaching things holistically. This makes sense, as this is also encouraged in society, especially these days, in the way of grouping ourselves based on arbitrary surface characteristics and in thinking that it's better to live separated whilst adhering onto a very specific and self-serving ideology rather than view everyone as an integral part of a greater whole that functions better by focusing on similarities as opposed to differences. We tend to think that if we break nature down to quantifiable bits, that we will understand how it works. This approach might be more efficacious if we keep in mind that the smaller parts are but holographic slivers of the whole, and that everything in between is important to make it all work in the most beneficial way for all. Today's guest, Dr. Jack Hunter, believes that there should not be an arm's length between the subject and the observer, and that it serves the subject more to take them on their own terms as opposed to superimposing one's presuppositions upon them. He has applied this to the paranormal and is here today to discuss it with me. I start off the conversation by asking Jack what it is that his work is about.
Technically, my background is in anthropology, so I am an anthropologist and my PhD is in anthropology. My undergraduate degree was in archaeology and anthropology, so I got quite a broad interest in the study of human beings, you know, whether we're talking about in the past or in the present day.
Sure.
But the main gist of my research has been on how contemporary people, so people who are living today, interpret and have, you know, paranormal experiences, different kinds of extraordinary experiences. So my PhD research was based with a group of spirit mediums in Bristol in the UK called the Bristol Spirit Lodge. And basically what they did was they would have weekly seances where they would develop different mediums. So they had a group of four or five mediums who would attend regularly, and they would sit in sessions with the circle leader, maybe on a one-to-one basis and sometimes in a bigger group, and just develop trance communication. So they would go into altered states and then allow spirits to communicate through them. So that's what my research was about. Uh-huh. It actually started off as when I was doing my undergraduate dissertation. And when I was doing that field work and sort of, you know, talking with these people, trying to find out what was going on, you know, what they believed and all that kind of stuff, I realized that what you really need in order to deal with something like this is kind of like a complexity kind of approach. So a non-reductive approach. And that's what my PhD ended up becoming, was sort of exploration of how it could be possible to have a non-reductive anthropology of mediumship in particular, but paranormal in general. So how can we study these things without trying to reduce it down all the time to either to explain it away in terms of fraud or delusion, or in terms of, you know, like illness or something like that, or whatever, brain chemistry. Instead of trying to reduce it down to any one of those single things, I actually tried to understand it in its kind of, you know, natural complexity. And it means you have to take into consideration the experience, how people have those experiences, how they interpret them, the beliefs that form around those experiences, the social groups that form around, you know, people who have these experiences, like mediumship development groups and things like that. And then within those social groups, there's all sorts of different kinds of, you know, social functions that they perform, like for bereavement and for providing a sense of community and bonding, as well as all of the other super weird or deep weird paranormal stuff that goes on in those kinds of groups as well. So that's really what my work has been about, is how can we approach these complex things in a complex way.
Oh yeah, as they deserve, for sure.
Yeah.
So that the idea behind writing Manifesting Spirits was sort of documenting that journey, that experience.
Yeah, Manifesting Spirits is the book that came out of my doctoral thesis. So basically, it's a kind of, there are some bits in the actual thesis that was submitted to the university that were a bit, you know, tedious and just put in there because that's what you've got to do.
Yes.
In methodology and stuff like that. Uh-huh. But essentially, the book is the whole of the thesis. So yeah, it explores the background, some of the history of sort of academic and scholarly engagement with the paranormal, and particularly within anthropology. And then that's kind of like the bedrock. And then my own experience with the Bristol Spirit Lodge comes then as a kind of extra layer of that. And how can you put some of these ideas into practice and investigate stuff in this kind of open-minded, participatory way?
Which I think is very, very important. And one thing I found fascinating about it, usually you hear books and anthropologists writing books about going to a different culture in a different continent, much far removed from where their comfort zone is, and they can sort of develop an arm's length, like, oh, these quote unquote primitive people, you know, have this way of going about things, and of course they don't know any better because they, you know, they're not versed in Western science the way that we are, so on and so forth. So they're kind of looking down their nose at these people. But this is, I mean, you didn't even have to, you stayed in your same country. You went to some place that probably wasn't that far away, and you immersed yourself in it, which I think is, I thought was fantastic. There was no arm's length. You went in very open-minded, right?
Yeah. It was very close by. It was an interesting way that it kind of came about, because initially I became interested in spiritualism as a way to study, or as a kind of particular field to study the paranormal in. Mm-hmm. Because in Bristol at the time when I was living there, there were about 10 spiritualist churches in the city. And these are like, you know, organized spiritualist churches with visiting mediums who go around and they kind of do like church service kind of things. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. But when I tried to engage with those groups, I found it much more difficult to kind of get into the kinds of conversations that I want to have with people. You know, like I would see them during a congregation gathering, and then I maybe not see them again. So it was a bit different.
Sure.
So I started to look for more intimate kinds of groups, because I had attended a psychic development circle, so I knew that these things existed. And I did a bit of searching online, and I found the group that, you know, the Bristol Spirit Lodge, and they were literally only a 20-minute walk up the road from where I was living. Uh-huh. It was very, very local to me at the time. Uh-huh. But the interesting thing about studying these things, like you suggested, in, you know, contemporary Western settings, is that, you know, a lot of the established ideas in anthropology are based on those older Victorian anthropologists and the work that they did. And people like E.B. Tyler, for instance, you know, one of the founding fathers of anthropology, all of his work was based around the idea that paranormal experiences or even religious beliefs were essentially like, you know, like superstitious kinds of things that had been superseded by scientific rationalism and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, part of their model for that was a kind of evolutionist, or they call it a developmentalist model, you know, where primitive cultures were less evolved, and then you'd climb up the ladder until you got to the pinnacle of evolution, which was Victorian, you know, English high society, essentially. But the interesting thing is, you know, even Tyler, although he didn't publish these things publicly, even Tyler had participated and done field work with spiritualist mediums in, you know, Victorian London, and had himself some very, you know, strange experiences with people like D.D. Hume and, you know, really high-ranking kind of mediums of the spiritualist movement. And Tyler only wrote about it in his private diaries. But the interesting thing about that was that, you know, essentially if he had published publicly, you know, that he'd attended these seances in contemporary Victorian society, and that he himself had been baffled by the experiences that he'd had, then that whole developmentalist evolutionist model would have collapsed.
Yes.
Because exactly those kinds of experiences and beliefs that he was saying were primitive and, you know, evolved out, were actually thriving, you know, at that time, all throughout Europe and America. So, and it's the same today. So, you know, studying those groups today in the 21st century is still challenging those same ideas that these are primitive, that they're superstitious ideas, and that they're from, you know, other cultures that are far away.
Yeah.
They're not. You know, they're indigenous ideas to Western culture as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And what I like about spiritualism is that there's no hierarchy, it seems. And as far as they're concerned, to my understanding, anybody is capable of being a medium. Anybody can talk to spirits. And you went into that. Well, actually, before we get into that, maybe tell us a little bit about what your first experience with the Bristol Spirit Lodge. How did you get a hold of them? And were they open to you as a quote-unquote anthropologist coming in and...
Yeah, well, I was an undergraduate in my third year, final year of my degree. And so I was doing my dissertation on, writing my dissertation about why, it was basically, why do people believe in spirits, you know? And so I went to find these people who believed in spirits to find out. And what I found out was, you know, that they basically had experiences, and the whole process of doing seances, the whole setup, in fact, everything about it was geared towards producing experiences for the people who were there, because spiritualism is all about providing evidence for survival after death or for the spiritual world. So it's very kind of like, it's very evidence-based. They want something to be produced.
Sure.
They want to be able to see things. So this is what really, you know, interested me as well, that was that hear that, you know, they were really trying to be open and allow people in to investigate stuff. And even later on, as I was doing this, they became more kind of outgoing, and they invited other people in to come and observe the seances that they were doing. They actually invited Susan Blackmore in, who is a very well-known, you know, skeptic of the paranormal, very outspoken and, you know, widely known, really, especially for her work on, you know, near-death experiences and that kind of thing. So I was like, whoa, this is a bit, you know, this is a crazy thing to do, really, to invite someone like an arch skeptic into one of these seances with a visiting physical medium, who is supposed to be producing ectoplasm and all this kind of stuff. You know, I thought it's like, but this is the attitude that they have, you know, even today, is that they want skeptics to come in because they believe that they are genuinely, you know, doing something, that they're making contact with the spiritual world. And, you know, maybe they are as well.
Well, so, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Well, did you go into this with any sort of experience that would lead you in this direction, or did it just sort of randomly come across your radar and you went, oh wow, let's look into that? I mean, did you have experiences when you were growing up, or were you raised in a family that was open to stuff like that?
I was raised to be very critical of things like religion and that kind of thing, and I wasn't raised religious or anything like that. I haven't been christened or anything. So I'm totally like a pagan,
a heathen,
which is good. Yeah, heathen. So yeah, but at the same time, growing up, there was a lot of. I moved from Liverpool, which is a big city, obviously, when I was 4 years old, so as a young child, to live in the countryside in Wales, in the hills. And growing up in this area, I think there is a lot of magic embedded in the land, which I've only more recently started to appreciate, which we might talk about later on or something.
For sure.
But that I also had, I encountered magic in the form of people practicing Wicca quite early on. My best friend's older brother was very interested in Wicca, and I became interested in Wicca as well, and did some rituals and things like that a little bit. Which, you know, led me down particular routes of thinking about things. And also, I remember one of my friend's mums was interested in these kinds of things. And she sent us out on a quest one day to find, you know, like quartz crystals and stuff to bring back to her for some kind of thing. So I always had this kind of feeling as well that there were real people, you know, out there who were engaging in magic and who believed in that kind of thing as well. So I was aware of it. And then as I was growing up and becoming, you know, we got into a band and things like that. And in a band, we started to experiment with magic mushrooms and stuff.
Yes, yes.
In fact, actually, it may have had the mushrooms just before we started the band, but...
Which anyway. Maybe led to the band.
Exactly. It's quite a common yes. motif.
Yes, Steve.
But also my first mushroom trip had a fairy experience embedded into it, which was quite a powerful experience. And I saw this in the grain of wood of a chest of drawers. The drawer was kind of hanging out. And in the grain of wood, I saw these sort of two-dimensional, I always describe them as looking like Brian Froud kind of fairy creatures.
Wow.
And they kind of turned in two dimensions. Like it was like an animation, and they clocked me and noticed me. But they were really, you know, they weren't interested in me. They clocked that I'd spotted them, but they weren't fussed. And then they kind of carried on with their procession, and I lost interest in it and drifted off. But I remember the next day talking to, I think my mum or someone came to pick me up, you know, for my friend's house, and we were all probably a little bit boggled and trying to pretend that nothing had happened and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I said that I'd seen fairies, and I remember that, you know, my mum's not like anti that kind of thing, and she told us about fairies growing up and whatever, but not in a serious way. But she was kind of like a little bit negative about the experience that I'd had, in a way. You know, she was like, you know, it's a bit weird, to a strange thing to say. And that got me thinking as well, you know, like, there are certain kinds of experiences that you can have that can be very powerful and real to you, and kind of, you know, a big deal. And then you can tell someone else, and because of whatever reasons, it can be dismissed, or it can be looked down on, or it can be interpreted as a sign of pathology or something like that. So that's kind of what led me into being interested in this question of spirits, and how can we study something like that, you know, something interesting and weird like that, but in a way that takes it seriously.
Yeah, for sure. So that was probably very appealing, as you sort of alluded to before, to go to a place where they weren't afraid of people coming in and really examining and analyzing what they were doing, because they were, you know, they were very confident in their practice, obviously.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they felt like they were doing something. And I think, you know, for the most part, I should point out that, you know, this group, for the most part, although they were developing physical mediumship, which is ectoplasm and levitation of objects and stuff, for the most part, the mediums there were just doing sort of like trance mediumship. Because obviously, in spiritualism, physical mediumship is thought of as kind of like quite highly developed ability, although it is also looked down on as quite a lowly ability as well.
Because it's so coarse.
It's coarse and bodily and things like that.
Sticky.
So, but anyway, only some mediums are able to produce ectoplasm. So for the most part, the mediums that were at the lodge, the regular mediums, although they were working towards that, they were just doing this sort of trance mediumship. And to be fair, that was the thing that got me really interested, not the ectoplasm, because I didn't see much of that. I only saw ectoplasm on a couple of occasions with a visiting medium, and I describe in the book you know, how kind of dodgy and dubious the whole thing was, but in an interesting way. But it was the trances of the everyday kind of normal mediums that were attending that I found really sort of convincing that something genuine was going on. You know, people were going into trances, they were going into altered states, and they were having strange experiences that they were reporting at the end of seances. And I had my own kinds of experiences like that as well. So it just that was the kind of thing that really, you know, clinched it for me, was the fact that, you know, people were having experiences that, you know, you couldn't necessarily explain away in any way. You know, they were important experiences for people. So that was the conclusion that I came to at the end of my undergraduate dissertation, was that it was all, you know, it really grounded in experience. And that's why people believe in spirits, is because they have experiences with spirits. And then in my, for the PhD, then it was, you know, expanding on that and taking it a step further as well.
Well, since they openly invited skeptics into their circle, did they go to the usual sort of traditional measures of tying the medium's wrists and ankles and stuff like that?
Yeah, and this is what happened with me the first time I came to one of the physical seances as well. Usually the person who's a guest or a skeptic or someone coming in to observe gets the honor of, you know, going around the seance room to look for booby traps. Uh-huh. And to bind the medium up and all of this kind of stuff, so you can tie them up as hard as you want, and you can put the cable ties on as tight as you like, and all of these kind of things.
I love it.
So it's kind of also a part of the whole performance of it, really, I guess, is you get the newcomer and the skeptic to do all of that stuff, so that in principle, I suppose, it's more you know, convincing and exciting when something actually does happen.
For sure.
But I remember I spent quite a long time tying up this physical medium the first time that I had to do that. And, you know, I know that it's possible to get out of knots and all of these kinds of things. You know, escapologists do it, and Houdini and all of that kind of stuff. You know, it's kind of like you know, common entertainment knowledge that people do that kind of thing. But at the same time, there was one time in this seance where I'd done all of this, and that one of the spirits said, do you know what teleportation is? And I said, I said something like, something silly, like, I think it's when something teleports from one place to another. And they, you know, the spirits laughed. And then they said, do you want to experience it? And then they said, we'll make the ropes that you've just tied on, you know, teleport into your lap. And they said, count to three. So we counted to three. And then on three, you know, the ropes were in my lap.
Wow.
So that was strange. But, you know, at the same time, it's not beyond possibility that he could have slipped, the medium could have slipped out of them and chucked them across onto them.
Well, did they go back?
In the darkness of a seance room, yeah, it's like a Schrodinger's cat kind of thing.
So did they end up going back on the medium, though?
I don't think they went back on the medium. I think I kept them on my lap for the rest of the seance.
Gotcha. Took them home as a souvenir.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, the spirits that these, well, at least the Bristol Spirit Lodge, but I think most spiritualist circles contact, they're not really like necessarily related to any people in the circle, right? They just happen to be spirits that are showing interest in having a communication with these people.
Yeah, there was there was an exception in the group. One of the mediums, her main kind of spirit control was her dead brother. So that kind of spirit guide kind of relationship is often there. But in general, the spirits that are gathered around, like each medium had, they call them a spirit team, a team of spirits that would come through regularly, you know, for the medium. Some of them would come through more than others and would have much more sort of highly developed personalities, and others that only came through quite infrequently were maybe less complex kind of personalities. But the ones that came through most frequently, yeah, became kind of like, and this was the other thing that really interested me about it, was that in the moment that these spirits were communicating through the medium, they were just as much a member. You know, if we're just thinking purely in terms of social things going on, you know, the spirits become just as much a social part of the group as a normal human being. And yet ostensibly, you know, it's a different personality coming through the medium's body. So that was the other thing that really interested me, was how tangible the spirits actually were in these seances for people. You know, it's not like some lofty kind of abstract idea about spirits. These are actually, you know, people that you can form a relationship with, you know, over weeks and months and things. And they actually did have, you know, they did have a rapport with the group, and they enjoyed communicating with each other and having the banter and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, the spirits at the very least were socially real.
Yeah.
At the very least, you know, they're socially real. So again, you know, once you admit to the social reality, which is what a lot of sociologists and anthropologists will admit, that spirits are socially real, but then they can't go much further than that. But that, you know, once you admit that they are socially real, then you have to say, well, they're socially, what does that mean? Where does that social reality come from?
Exactly. What does that mean, socially real? That everybody in the society acknowledges their existence?
In the spiritualist society.
Okay. Gotcha. And do different people in the circle channel the same set of spirits, or does each person have their own group of spirits that they deal with?
Yeah, usually each medium has their own group.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I counted at the time that I did my field that they had, some of the mediums had up to 16 different spirits, regular spirits that would come through. But like I was saying, usually it was just a smaller group of those who were much more developed.
Yeah.
But an interesting thing with, when it gets into the kind of like the higher, or however you want to think about it, the physical mediums, for instance, and the more advanced trance mediums, there is sometimes a bit of a crossover between the spirits that come through. So you can have like, there are, sort of like celebrity spirits. There are celebrity spirits like Winston Churchill and Louis Armstrong, for example, who come through lots of different mediums, because they have very strong kind of personalities, I guess, that can be easily expressed. But there are also sort of famous spirit guides as well, who sometimes appear or sometimes crop up through different mediums, ostensibly anyway. So, for instance, there was one instance when I was doing my field work where one of the visiting mediums was claiming to channel one of the spirits of one of the spirit guides of Colin Fry, who was a famous, mental medium and trance medium who died a few years ago. But there's a weird tension there then, between who's channeling the real spirit. Is it really the same spirit? And then there's this idea as well of sort of like poaching other people's spirit guides.
Interesting.
Bringing them into your spirit team, and they become a regular fixture of your seances. So it's interesting. It's very strange. And as the other thing, sorry, I'm going off on one now.
Go, please do.
The other thing that's interesting about these physical mediums is that they're kind of like moving around on a circuit, and they go to different sanctuaries where they'll give demonstrations for payment as well. So that you can think as well that there might be a benefit to them to having celebrity spirit guides as part of their spirit teams and things like that. Or if you can channel a famous spirit guide, then people will be more interested to attend.
Exactly. Knowing that they're going to have this person show up or the spirit show up. Kai Muga comes to mind. He was my very first episode. That's who I interviewed. Have you had any experience with him at all?
Yeah, well, I haven't attended any of his seances yet, unfortunately, but I have been in touch with him and communicated with him, and I followed the research that's been done with the Felix Group, because they kind of started off around about the same time that I was doing my field work, but obviously we're doing a much more advanced level of mediumship with all of the ectoplasm and that kind of thing. But I know, a few years ago, there was a lot of interest in the group from parapsychologists as well. And there was a lot of controversy about the genuineness of the phenomena, as there always is with physical mediumship. But some people, like Stephen Browdy, saying that there was something genuine going on here, and others being a little bit more critical. But, that's the way it is with physical mediumship.
Exactly. Or a mixture of both, which I think confuses the matter too.
Yeah, and that became a big part of manifesting spirits, thinking about the relationship between trickery and performance and actual spirit manifestation, and how actually, if we think about these things in more of a cross-cultural context, then we can see, in all sorts of different traditions around the world, different kinds of mediumship and shamanistic traditions, the body is used as a performance tool in very particular kinds of ways to express the presence of spirits. And they learn these techniques of performance. And it's not understood as, it's not understood like in Western acting as fake. Actually, when you're performing the role of a spirit, it's an actual transformation, and you're embodying that spirit in your performance. So I started to think, why is it that when we look at something like physical mediumship in the West, we can't bring these kinds of subtle nuances to it? It always has to be just purely in terms of fraud or reality.
Yeah.
But, if you look in the anthropological literature, there's all sorts of studies of things like Balinese spirit possession and shamanism in, like Siberia and things like that, that focuses in real detail on the performance and how they use their bodies and all of these kind of things, what the symbols that they're using and all that kind of stuff. And no one ever does that with Western mediumship. They don't think about the way that mediums use their bodies to express spirits and all that kind of thing. So again, it comes back to that thing we were talking about before, that as long as, you know, you can do that kind of stuff as long as it's out there and away, you know, far away in exotic places.
Exactly.
But you can't do it in your own, you know, culture.
Mm-hmm. For sure. No, I think it's interesting that something like this occurs in such a, I'm assuming it's the same way all over Europe for the most part, but in such a highly materialist, reductionist context, you know, science, materialist science is sort of the new kind of religion in a sense. And to have something like this taking place within that context with a very open-minded, open-door policy that wants these critics to come in, I think it's fantastic. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, where the spirit world sort of crosses over into physical mediumship, we're so obsessed with the tangible. So here is a situation where the spirit world is supposedly sort of projecting itself into the tangible world. And I just find that highly fascinating.
I do too. And the other thing that I really find interesting about it is the kind of, the sort of, my main informant, the circle leader, Christine, she described herself as having this DIY housewifey interest in science. And that really kind of just, that little phrase, that's her words, really clicked in my mind that these groups are kind of like, you know, it's like folk science or, you know, it's everyday people science, everyday people doing, investigating and doing their own research and, but in a very particular kind of interesting area.
Yes.
So they're doing all of this research on, you know, subjective states and trance experiences and that kind of stuff, but in this home circle setting within the home. So it's just fascinating.
Yeah. They're getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, exactly. With real research.
Yes.
Long-term research that, you know, at the time that I had visited them, they'd already been going for 4 years or, you know, two or three or 4 years or something like that. By now, you know, 10 years later, you know, Christine must have participated in thousands of seances. You know, she must have a huge amount of experience by now of discerning trance states in people and the different kinds of behaviors and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
Absolutely. So what was it, what was the first time that you, the first circle that you sat in? What tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Yeah. The first seance that I went to was actually probably one of the most powerful ones for me. And it was one that I was still an undergraduate, and it was one that kind of blew away my misconceptions about spiritualism and that kind of thing. Because, you know, when you think about a seance from popular culture, you think about, you know, like Victorian mansions and big tables and things like that with people sitting around with their hands on the table and stuff. And it's dark and there might be like a thunderstorm outside and things like that.
Of course.
But actually this seance, I had to get up early in the morning to attend it because it was at 9 a.m. and, you know, I was a student, so that was difficult for me to get my head around. And in fact, the day that I went, there had been a snowfall in the night in Bristol, which is quite far south in the UK for snow, really, but there had been a heavy snowfall and the roads were really treacherous and slippy. So when I was walking there, you know, I had to really concentrate to actually get there, which I think added something to it. I'd had to go through a little bit of an ordeal to get to my first seance.
Yeah.
And I could have conceivably, you know, sent her an email and said, nah, I'm not going to turn up today. It's too icy. But I didn't. I got through it and I went. And when I got to the door, you know, she was like, I didn't think you were actually going to turn up. But I did. So then we went through. I'd already spoken to her. I'd been to her house, I think, to interview her just one-to-one earlier. So, but this was the first actual seance. And we went in and she had a dining table in her dining room that was all laid out with mats, placemats with people's names on it who were coming to visit. And my placemat with my name on it, Jack, was at the top of the table right next to Christine. And I think, again, this is like, you know, it's my first experience going to the seance. So I go at the top of the table and get to observe everything and all of this kind of stuff. And then the medium turned up and the sitters turned up and we just sort of sat around having a drink of tea and things like that. It was all very kind of, you know, like a suburban and housewifey
informal
kind of vibe. Yeah. And I was obviously, you know, I was out of place myself in that environment, but I was there. And then we went out into the lodge, which is where they held the seances, which is like a shed in the garden, which is actually now, retrospectively, with my interest in ecology and gardening and things, a really interesting aspect of the whole thing that I hadn't considered at the time. Because every time we went to go to the seance to participate, we had to walk through the garden. And, you know, the garden was wonderful. Christine did a great job of tending the garden. A good job of tending the garden and a good job of tending mediums as well, which is interesting. Anyway, we went into the shed and the medium, Sandy, was a very kind of like quiet person. She was quite reserved and held back and quite shy to talk to. But then she went and sat in the cabinet, which is a corner, you know, the corner of the room basically has curtains hanging down and there's a big high back chair in there with, you know, arms on it so you can sit on there. And she took her shoes off. We all had to take our shoes off to go into the lodge and sit down. And there was tables all around the edge, not tables, chairs all around the edge of the room so that we could sit down. Yeah, so we went into the lodge. And there was all chairs around the edge of it. And we could sit there and it was cold, obviously, because it had been snowing. So we had blankets on our laps and things like that. And Sandy was sitting in the cabinet and she started to, when they turned the lights down, they turned them down to a red light and they put on some sort of music and Christine read an opening prayer, which basically invited spirits to, you know, make themselves known. It's actually an interesting prayer. It calls out to the Heavenly Father and spirit friends and asks them to come and give evidence, you know, that they exist, basically. So it's kind of a prayer. It's also kind of a setting of intent for the seance. And that's kind of how they think about it. It's an intention thing. And, you know, they draw on like Lynn McTaggart and that kind of you know, popular science stuff to kind of justify it, which is interesting. And then after the prayer, the music comes on and the medium starts to go into her trance. And she started to sort of make weird sort of like grunting noises. And, she, you know, she was very quiet and all of that kind of stuff when I first met her. And then all of a sudden she's in the lodge in the cabinet and she's making these strange noises and she starts like rocking backwards and forwards and things like that and pushing herself up on the arms of the chair and all these kind of things. And she starts like stretching her arms out in strange ways like this and moving around in different kinds of ways. And these were recognized, and this is something that I became interested in, that these movements were recognized by the circle leader as kind of indicating the presence of particular spirits. So some spirits would move in particular ways, or they would have certain gestures that they did with their hands to let you know that they were coming through. So sometimes they would have, you know, more than one spirit trying to make itself known through her simultaneously, you know, moving her legs, moving her hands, which was really interesting. And then she started to talk in different voices. And her main spirit guide came through and started talking to us and all this kind of stuff, which was all super interesting, obviously, because I'd never experienced anything like that before. But the sort of icing on the cake of the whole thing for me was I started to have what I thought of at the time as sort of like hallucinations, you know, in the seance room. It was low light levels and all that kind of stuff, all perfect for inducing Yeah, like I was saying, all perfect for inducing weird experiences. I think actually, you know, seance room is kind of like a psychomantium kind of thing. Everything about it is geared towards making you hallucinate and all that kind of stuff. So I saw these little speckles of light behind the medium in the back of the cabinet. And I'd read about phosphenes and entoptics, you know, because in cave paintings and things, you get these little images that they think represent, you know, things that you see as hallucinations in low light levels or low oxygen and that kind of thing. So it felt like that kind of thing, you know, the gloom of the place was just triggering stuff. And then I saw the strangest part of it was I saw over, sort of forming over the face of the medium, this like green mask that looked like a Chinese monk. You know, if you think of like a Shaolin monk, stereotypical kind of image, like bald face. It was like that. And it kind of formed over the face of the medium. And it just sort of like slid down real slowly like that and dissipated. And like I was saying, it was like those little phosphenes, the little flashing lights. It felt like it was some kind of hallucination. I didn't think at the time that it was a physical thing out there. You know, I was like, I'm visualizing this, you know.
It's coming from you.
But then, yeah, I thought it was coming from me, and I was, because of the situation and all that kind of stuff, projecting it out in some way.
Yeah.
But when we went into the, and I kept it all to myself, I didn't mention it, because I thought it was a hallucination. But when we went out into the house again at the end of the seance, and when all the spirits had been, you know, sent on their way back to the spirit world, and all the energy at the end of the seance, they say all any excess energies in the room should be used for purposes of healing. So every seance is also kind of like a healing session as well. Anyway, we went back out into the house to have tea and biscuits again, and we were talking about the things that we'd seen and how interesting it was and all that kind of stuff. And one of the other regular sitters said, did you see that green face? And I wasn't expecting this kind of thing. You know, I didn't want to go there and, you know, on my first seance have like weird experiences and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't a part of the plan.
Sure.
But it happened. And it just so happened to be this strange hallucinatory experience that was seemingly shared with someone that I'd never met before. You know, basically like she was like a suburban granny, this lady. So, you know, super weird for my first experience.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I had a bit of a decline effect with the seances. There were a couple of other peaks. Like I've talked about it before, my possessed hand experience, which I described in the book as well, when my left hand seemed to be possessed, essentially. But in general, the kind of experiences that I had petered out, and it became boring for me going to these seances regularly. So I stopped, gradually as my research came to an end, I started to go less frequently, and then it just petered out. I haven't been to a seance now for quite a few years. And I haven't had any kinds of mediumistic kinds of experiences since those days, which is interesting.
It is interesting.
But the point of my highest involvement in it, I did. And the experiences that I had, you know, the point when I was first really into it and engaged in it, I had other experiences that came home with me as well. I was waking up at night and having weird hypnagogic kind of visions. I saw one kind of like big green again, which is interesting, like the green face. Green goat's head.
Whoa.
Yeah, that appeared above my bed this was at the time that I first started getting interested in spiritualism and going to the seances and things. So I was well into it. And, you know, I woke up at night and I saw this great big goat's head kind of thing, kind of like revolving around, like turning, you know, really weird. And another one that I had at that time was a similar kind of waking up in the night and seeing like big ships, you know, like the bows of ships and waves. It's just like very strange. But, you know, that was at the beginning. And then again, they petered out and I didn't have other kinds of paranormal experiences in that kind of intensity.
So yeah. it was more that the experiences weren't as sensational as they started off to be. It wasn't that you sort of became numb to them.
No, I don't think so. It was more that, yeah, because of my participation in it at the time. You know, it was a new project. It was going to be my thesis and all this kind of stuff, and I was super engaged in it. And that's kind of like my other book, Engaging the Anomalous. You know, when you are super engaged in it, then stuff starts to happen.
Sure.
And I was super engaged in it because I was able to be engaged in it. You know, it was at a time in my life when I could devote that time to it and participate in it fully. I wouldn't be able to do it today in the same way with kids and all of that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it is very much of a collaboration, right? It takes two, or in this case, a whole circle to make this stuff happen.
Yeah, it seems to. It's definitely a sort of a communal kind of manifestation.
Yeah. Which brings us to the let's see what the skull experiment, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But an instance that I found fascinating was that there was a sitter, I believe, in the circle at the Bristol Spirit Lodge who during these seances would communicate with his living wife who had Alzheimer's, right?
Yeah.
Tell us
that
about that.
That was super interesting. Yeah. There was a couple of very elderly members of the group. They were in their 80s at the time, so I don't know, they may not still be around anymore. But yeah, there was one guy, I think he was called Dave, and he had his partner Pam, and they'd become a couple. But Dave's wife was in a nursing home essentially. And Dave told me that he had communicated with his wife through a medium, because his wife couldn't communicate verbally anymore. He communicated with his wife through a medium in order to get her blessing that, you know, he could spend time with Pam essentially and have help from her and things at home and that kind of thing, which is a super interesting thing for someone to tell you. And it opens up lots of interesting things to think about, you know, like mediumship, not just the spirits of the dead clearly, but also, you know, to communicate with spirits of people who are living, but who maybe can't, who are incapacitated or can't communicate through their bodies.
Yeah.
Really amazing.
And they have a damaged interface between the spirit and the physical.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how he understood it. The Alzheimer's was basically, you know, the brain, different parts of the brain shutting down, which was preventing her spirit from being able to, yeah, to fully manifest.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So how much of a seance do you think is performance? Like, is it sort of a show, or is it, you know, not? And it just comes off as being a show because it's sometimes so sensational.
Yeah, it's definitely a show. even the seances that are sort of one-to-one, one in, you know, one medium and the sitter, are still a kind of a performance. I mean, the medium sits in the cabinet kind of essentially on a stage. You know, if you went back to the Victorian times, the cabinet often literally was a wooden cabinet on a stage with the medium inside it. So, you know, the medium is always performing it's kind of in the idea of being a medium as well. You know, you are the mediator, so you have to, you're the one who does the expressing for something that's invisible, so it has to be a performance. But it's also, it's ritualized, like I was saying, even though they have a, this kind of like DIY scientific approach to the seances, at the same time they still have the ritualized, you have to do the opening prayer to set the intention, to invite the spirits, to basically, they talk about a you know, bringing down a canopy of protection to protect away of evil, negative spirits that might want to make themselves, make mischief in the seance room and all that kind of stuff. And then obviously that time in the middle then is the liminal stage, you know, in Arnold van Gennep and Victor Turner's like structure, anti-structure, liminality thing, ritual structure. And it's in that middle stage when the spirits manifest, in that liminal time, when the medium's body is used to express spirits in trance mediumship. But in physical mediumship, that liminal time is very weird because the medium, there's no red lights in the physical seance. So, you know, with a trance seance, the liminal stage, you can still see the medium and you can have these visualizations and stuff. With a physical seance, it's in pitch darkness, essentially. So, like I was saying before, it's kind of like a Schrodinger's cat kind of thing. You can't verify anything. You don't know what's going on. The medium could well be out of the chair, walking around in pitch darkness and doing these different things. But you've got no way of actually checking, which I think is a part of the performative element of it. So if we think about mediumship more as like a, again, like a shamanistic technique or something like that, for altering people's consciousness and for putting them into different states where they might have communication with spiritual beings and stuff, then all of that is a part of the performance element of it. Kind of like, you know, you do certain things, you have the lighting in the right way to induce certain kinds of experiences, which then totally muddies the waters, because if the medium is genuinely doing some kind of a trick, you know, it's literally just turning the lights off and walking around in the room, but people are still having extraordinary experiences that are, you know, powerful and meaningful for them, then you can't just reduce it to fraud and trickery and performance. So it is both fraud and performance, but also has an experiential kind of value to it and efficacy. And I talked about Richard Schechner, the performance theorist. He had a good thing that he talked about, the efficacy entertainment braid in performances, and how actually no performance is ever just a performance or just for producing some kind of effect. Usually it's a mixture of both. They both have to be in there. Like you think of doctors and things as a good example, like, you know, you go to a doctor to be healed with medicine and all that kind of stuff, but you also want to be reassured and to feel as though you're talking to someone who knows what they're talking about and all of that kind of stuff, which is the performative element. So it's both effective and performative. And I think physical mediumship can be the same.
It seems like, I guess, one of the obvious giveaways that it is a performance is that they put music on. I mean, that seems sort of like they're kind of staging a backdrop of some emotional direction that you're trying to be nudged in. You know, I mean, I don't know. What kind of music was it?
Yeah. Really interesting, the music, because for the most part, it was kind of like popular music.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, popular music. High, you know, the idea is that, and this was what the even the Victorian spiritualists said, was that, you know, you needed to have like upbeat popular music to raise the vibrations, to raise the energy and get everyone kind of pumped up. Uh-huh. So on the one hand, you know, there were kind of like pop songs that were used quite frequently.
Interesting.
And often it's things like Queen and stuff like that.
Wow. You know,
Yeah.
Crazy.
I remember when I went to spiritualist churches, they were singing hymns in the church, but the hymns were pop songs. And they were singing things like Angels by Robbie Williams and stuff like that.
Wow.
You know, so they're like popular songs that have got this kind of spiritual vibe about them.
Interesting. Very postmodern.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing that they were listening to in the seances at the Bristol Spirit Lodge was kind of like New Age kind of music. There was a tune, I don't know who it's by, but it had kind of, it's quite a well-known tune with like a Native American kind of chant over the top of it that they used quite a lot in the seances. And then every seance would end with an instrumental piece. I think it was Hank Marvin and the Shadows. And it's just a lovely guitar piece of music that just brought every seance to the same kind of conclusion, which was nice.
Interesting.
But the other thing about music is it doesn't matter whether it's popular music or anything like that, because rhythms have always been, you know, beats are always associated with altered states of consciousness. Music is a tool for putting people into mass altered states or attracting people's attention.
Absolutely.
You know, and getting people on the beat together. So, you know, it doesn't matter what music they're using, really. I mean, whatever floats your boat, but music gets you into certain kinds of, you know, states. So it is a part of the performance. You know, it turns it into a spectacle and it turns it into like a musical event. It just brings to mind another thing, but it's also effective. But the other thing that I found really funny was the use of Harry Potter music in seances. And they would put on the Harry Potter theme tune. Uh-huh. And it was at the peak of all of the seance activity when there were supposed to be, you know, there are trumpets flying around in the room and tables floating around and things like that. And all the trumpets and tables have got little glow tabs on them. So you can see them moving around in the pitch darkness.
Wow.
But obviously you can't tell whether they're genuinely levitating or whether someone's moving them around or not. But they're all moving around and dancing along to the Harry Potter music, which is, again, you know, very postmodern kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that seems as good a place as any to end the first free hour. To hear the rest of the interview, a whole other hour, go to patreon.com/themeltpodcast, where for as little as $3 measly dollars a month, you can get full interviews, you can get exclusive episodes, and you can get early episodes. You can also get access to monthly Melt meetups. The last one was really intense and wonderful. The best one that we've had so far, and I only see them getting better. So there's that to think of. And there's also the option to subscribe yearly and get a discount. So it's much cheaper, or I should say somewhat cheaper, if you pay a year ahead of time. All right. In the second hour, we discuss ectoplasm, spirit objects, the skull experiment, the ontological turn, ethno-metaphysics, and much, much more. I really hope that you gleaned something positive from this episode. I found the conversation very enlightening, and Jack just really had a lot of great observations, and I really like the way that he approaches his field of study. I think it's to downplay the experiences of peoples and civilizations that have come before ours is a great, great, what is the word that I'm looking for? A great mistake. I think there's much, much to learn. And I think that those that came before us were more connected to the things that are real, the natural world, which I think a lot of our society and our, I don't know, for lack of a better term, civilization, current civilization, has really drastically lost track of. And I think that that can explain a lot of the ills that we experience in our world today. And I don't think it's irreversible. I think we can get back to that, but we have to want to bad enough. And it starts with one person at a time. So hopefully this conversation maybe got you a little closer to that place. I do want to emphasize my desire for you to subscribe to the Melt YouTube channel. We're very, very close to getting monetized, and I have never gotten monetized on YouTube before, so I don't know what that entails, but I think that will help the cash flow of the Melt considerably, and that will help to make the Melt something that I can put more of my time and my effort and my soul into. I only have so much time in a given week to put these things together, along with, you know, working a full-time job, being with my family, and the other things that one has to do day-to-day in their day-to-day lives. But I would love to put more time and effort into this and have the opportunity and the space to do that. So that will help us move towards that. All right. Great things ahead. Thank you so, so much for listening. It is greatly appreciated. And until next time, take care, people. If you've liked what you've heard and would like to contribute to The Melt, there are a few ways that you can do that. The most tangible would be financially. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and there you will find ways that you can contribute for as little as $3 a month. This will give you access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. Contributing financially will also help make The Melt better, pay the bills, and help to make this podcast a full-time endeavor that I can fully devote my time to and provide you with more content. Another way of contributing would be to go to wherever it is that you subscribe to The Melt and give it a favorable review or rating, and this will help it to reach more people. You can also spread the word to friends and family via social media, email, or word of mouth. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.